welcome to Sobremesa with me, your host, Alan Maguire. This is a one-off special, one of, I hope, many in the future that will be concentrating on the regional identity and history of each specific individual region within the Spanish nation. Each region has its own regional day, and I hope to broadcast on that day with somebody from that region that is able to explain the culture, the traditions, and individual aspects from that region. I hope to highlight and bring to the surface the many different aspects of the Spanish nation and how these regions feed into that larger picture of a nation. Today we're going to be starting with Catalonia. I have Alicia Hernandez Grande with me. She is a PhD candidate and researcher from Northwestern University. In this interview, we're going to be exploring the history of Catalonia, why the independence drive has picked up in recent years, and towards the end, we'll be talking a bit about the Catalan identity from a different perspective. I hope you enjoy the interview, and if you're from a region of Spain and you feel that you could add towards this project, then please get in contact. This is going to be a slow-burning project, and something I hope to do alongside the regular podcast. Remember to get the news of all these episodes, you need to subscribe to Sobremesa. So you can find us on most platforms, especially Google, Spotify, and Apple. You need to search for Sobremesa Podcast, and then hopefully you will be able to find us and subscribe to us. Last week we reached 100 listeners, and I'm hoping to reach 200 by Christmas. So please share this with your friends and family and anyone that you feel might be interested. Now, I hope you enjoy the interview. Thank you. Hello, welcome to Sobremesa. Today is the 11th of September, and it is Catalonia's National Day. With me today, I have Alicia Hernandez Grande. Hello, Alicia.
Hi, how are you?
Not bad, yourself?
Quite well.
So in today's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the history of the independence movement, but from a bit of a different perspective. And we're also then going to talk a bit about Catalan identity to keep in with our theme of identity on Sobremesa that we have going at the minute. So Alicia, you were an observer at the referendum, the famous referendum on October the 1st in 2017. It was as part of a research project, is that right?
Yes, it was part of my dissertation research.
Okay, what's that into?
So my dissertation looks at how during the Franco regime, there was a very vibrant theater scene that was actively using theatrical strategies to try to subvert the regime and bring forward democratic ideas in a dictatorial Spain. My dissertation specifically looks at how, with the transition and the beginning of democracy in Spain, the individuals involved in this theater scene transitioned into more political venues, including the independence movement. So all of these mass protests and some of the events seen on October 1st, 2017, are linked back to kind of a performance genealogy of resistance.
Wow. And so did they spread into independence movement and political parties? Is it just Catalonia they spread to, or was it different areas?
Yeah, it's a little different everywhere. The reality is that theater during the Franco regime was not, you had professional theater that was very, very censored. But this kind of theater that was much more nomadic was done a lot often by university students. It wasn't something they were making money off of. So once the dictatorship ends, I mean, it also coincides with the fact that these actors are graduating from university or trying to figure out what they're doing with their lives. And politics was a natural place to go, especially because a lot of the theater that they've been doing was political in nature. Mm-hmm. But I will say that it goes in both directions. Perhaps the most famous theater maker from this era is Albert Boadella from Catalonia, that is now, you know, very famously a very vocal and spectacular opponent of Catalan independence and Catalan autonomy. Right. So there's quite a lot of engagement into politics, not always for leftist or Catalan causes.
So you went to the referendum as an observer, right?
Yes.
What was it like? I mean, can you give us a bit of a taste of, you know, what you saw and, you know, how was it? And you've got an article, haven't you, called, is it Welcome to the Catalan Republic?
Mm-hmm.
I'll put a link into that on the podcast. It's definitely a brilliant article. Well done. It's a very good article, very informative. But can you tell our readers, listeners, what it was like?
Yeah, absolutely. I spent the day between three different polling stations in central Barcelona. And it was, I mean, kind of the event started the night before. You know, it's Barcelona in late September, so it's still very nice weather. And it's common to have people out late at night. But this was, you know, walking through Barcelona with all the terraces pretty packed, but also there's a lot of tension in the air. Even the adamant independent supporters kind of knew that the referendum wouldn't necessarily lead to a referendum or to independence. They knew that there would be, I mean, the city had been, especially Barcelona, but other cities in Catalonia as well, had been slowly filling with this police presence from the Spanish government. So it was just kind of like this slow increase of anxiety. And then the morning of, so because most polling stations in Spain are local schools or public buildings, and then the Spanish government, which was opposed to the referendum, had tried to lock down buildings. So there were some people that had stayed in the buildings from Friday night, often, like, you know, instead of when they went to pick up their children, they instead stayed at the polling station.
Mm-hmm.
So you had these very long lines that formed outside the schools at around 5 a.m. It was drizzling. It wasn't very nice to be outside. And yet everybody got there very early. Doors opened. Everybody was kind of crowding in to try to get away from the rain. And then just kind of anxiously waiting for the polls to begin in these very tightly packed crowds. And tightly packed primarily because it was raining. It's a little strange to think about those crowds in today's like social distancing, because it was definitely not COVID friendly whatsoever. And then as the day went on, especially, I mean, I think many people had voted, like the polls opened around 9 a.m. Many people were trying to get there and vote as soon as they opened because they were afraid of police interventions that would stop it. One of the stations that I was at, the police did come. And it was essentially a very peaceful meeting. They essentially said, you can't do this. Everybody was peaceful. It was just one police car. They knew that they weren't gonna get anywhere, so they left. But in that moment, you had a surge of people get to the entrance to try to block entry to the police officers. So you had this like very tense feeling, and yet simultaneously, everybody knew what they were there for and how to react to an outside presence. I will say that as news got out from other polling locations in Barcelona and other parts of the region, where clashes between protesters and police were much more violent, that also started this kind of wave of anxiety. It felt like the Wi-Fi or any kind of internet access was very, very spotty the whole way through. Like, it was never clear what was happening. It was never clear where police was coming from. It was never clear if they were even coming. And you just saw this kind of increasing tension. I remember quite a lot of people that were in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, making references to the Franco regime, talking about how like this is how it used to be, making a lot of comparisons in that moment. Making a lot of statements about like, but we will, like, you know, I've faced them in the 70s, I will face them again.
Right,
so a lot of collapsing between contemporary politics and kind of more historical moments. And yeah, I personally did not witness any police brutality, but it was just a very interesting event in that rising tension. Once the majority of people had voted, things relaxed quite a bit. And then by the afternoon, especially people had stayed away from the large crowd, so elderly people or people with various young children or things like that, reasons like that to stay away from the crowds, then started coming in the afternoons because things had become much more festive and much more calm. So it was an interesting day as far as that kind of like increase in tension into a more calm, festive, civic moment. But it was, it was very interesting. And I was particularly struck by this kind of consistent, and I mean, it's a messaging that's throughout the independence movement, but this kind of consistent collapse between historical events, the Spanish Civil War, the Franco regime, and contemporary politics, where voting in the referendum, which is a future-looking project, supposedly, Catalan independence is meant to be future-looking, but voting in this referendum was making a statement about past events. Was revindicating people's families that were killed or exiled or whatever during the Spanish Civil War, during the Franco regime. So it didn't particularly feel that day, as much as there was an element of like, this is hopeful for the future. It also very much felt like this is a return to the past. It's righting the wrongs of history. In a way that was very interesting.
And it's quite strange that, I mean, that's a really interesting observation, because the thing that has always struck me as an interesting thing about Catalan independence and the referendum is it's not a left-wing project. You know, it's not a, it's like a left and a right-wing project. So that's that's really interesting to hear that. What was, you say the evening got more festive. Is this where the sort of the theater aspect that you were looking at comes into play, or where does it relate to your research, is I suppose what I'm asking.
There were certainly some elements later on as things got more festive. So what I mean by that is festive as far as people I mean, there was a relaxation in general of tensions. Like I said, older, especially elderly people who had a hard time walking or in wheelchairs or things like that were brought by family members to vote. And they were almost always greeted by lines of people clapping and cheering them on. Really felt like that, again, that revindication of like the generation of that lived through the Spanish Civil War coming in to vote in the referendum. Flags began to be flown. There was a big push at the beginning of the day and throughout the referendum, really, to try to make the experience as civic-minded as possible. So as much as they expected the majority of voters would vote for independence, there was never a push to keep people away who would vote for no. And I didn't personally see this, but it was very visible on social media of individuals coming to vote vote no in a Spanish flag or wearing elements that clearly marked that they were anti-independence. And they were also greeted with claps. They were, their hands were shaken. There was this kind of welcoming of opposing voices, because ultimately, like the ultimately, as you said, with this, it's not a left or right movement. It's not a specific, like there's a strong attempt in Catalonia to make independence be about the democratic process instead of about a specific party. Now, whether or not independence is actually just simply the democratic process versus politics at play is a whole long and complicated and interesting conversation. But there was a big push during the referendum to try to make it appear as civic-minded as possible. So people didn't wear political slogans on their shirts. They didn't carry around independence flags. They didn't sing songs or engage in behavior that they've been engaging in all of these other protests and will engage today on the National Day as they do every year. But as the night went on, as the polls closed, that behavior came back out. So the flags came back, the songs came back, that kind of behavior came back. And a lot of what my research is looking at, especially with the National Days, because they're a yearly event, and because if you've attended one of the early ones, like people attend every year. So what ultimately I argue ends up happening is that by attending every year, you learn certain elements of the protest. So whether that be songs, slogans, but also responses. So responses to police presence, responses to counter protesters. And what I was seeing with the referendum was kind of the fruit of all of that. And actually in the lead up to the referendum, Catalonia has this amazing ability, the Catalan independence movement has an amazing ability to call for a protest and have people show up immediately. So they send out a WhatsApp. There's already groups all over the place established via WhatsApp, via Telegram. And people arrive, and they arrive knowing the songs, they arrive knowing the slogans, they arrive, especially in the run-up to the referendum, I would see people, I mean, anything from students pulling shirts out of their backpacks to businessmen pulling flags out of their briefcases.
Wow, really?
Yeah. So in the sense of like class and age, it's a very diverse movement. And they were able and ready to go out on their lunch break or go out in the street and protest in a way that unites everybody because it's using the same kinds of songs, slogans, shirts, flags.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, I see where the theater element comes into it. That's really, and do you think it sort of gets rid of divides a bit, you know, between the rich and the poor, women, men, Catalans, non-Catalans, or is it like an inclusive act? Is it quite a...
Right. Yeah, it's a complicated question because ultimately there are many divisions within Catalonia as they are in any other European society. The Catalan independence movement, Catalonia in general, attempts to present itself and I think sincerely by a lot of people to be inclusive. Very recently, the first Muslim woman was voted into parliament, this regionals parliament, things like that. But it still ultimately becomes a little harder to be as inclusive when it comes to different races or religions or things like that, primarily because Spain in general is so homogeneous.
I will
point out though that the Catalan independence movement, as we pointed out earlier, is not a leftist project, or at least didn't start there. It started with the government of Pujol immediately after the transition. So Jordi Pujol is elected as the president of Catalonia shortly after the transition and stays as prime minister, as president, I believe until 2005, 2002. So he is there for a good 20 years.
Wow, really?
Yes, and he's consistently reelected, but his big kind of push, and he's from a more right-wing conservative religious party. And his big push is, as long as he pushes for independence, he can kind of blame everything on Spain. And there is a lot of that kind of partisanship. And I will say that it goes both ways. A lot of Spanish politics is blaming everything on Catalonia.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on both sides of the aisle, there's a lot of using the Catalan independence movement to kind of gain political power and political reach. In Pujol's case, he never necessarily was like, rah, rah, let's go for independence, let's vote right now, as future administrations from his have gone for. But instead, he just consistently spoke about Catalan identity and Catalan-ness to unite a broader base of people willing to vote for him than his specific policies might have otherwise attracted. And you still see that in the coalition for Catalan independence, which are these kind of hodgepodge of different parties, some of which are extremely left and some of which are pretty conservative comparatively. and that don't agree with much except for this kind of issue surrounding identity, surrounding autonomy from Spain, and surrounding independence from Spain.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, no, that's definitely, yeah, the ERC seem to be a bit more standing out nowadays. Like, they seem to be a bit more prominent.
Yeah.
I suppose after all that happened, though, you know, with the arrests and things, someone had to sort of take up some sort of position. So today is the Independence Day for Catalonia. Mm-hmm. It's the national day, isn't it? Is it? So why is that? I think you say something in your article about 1714. Is that right? Yeah. How are they linked? Are they linked?
Yeah. So it's a national day. It's a slightly paradoxical national day, because September 11th, 1714 is the day that a siege in Barcelona ends. This, what we would now call Spanish troops march in, and the region loses its autonomy. It loses its separateness from the rest of the peninsula.
Uh-huh.
So it's slightly paradoxical in being a national day, because it's the day that a poorly worded way to say it is the day they lose their independence. And I only say poorly worded because like the nation state of Spain doesn't exist at the time. Neither does the concept of Catalonia exist today.
Right. Okay.
It's uncertain. It's inexact wording, except that there's no kind of other way to describe it other than Spain versus Catalonia.
Yeah.
But yeah, 1714, it's towards the end of the war of Spanish succession. The what we now call Spain is supporting Philip V, the Bourbon king, who is connected to France, and the Catalan region puts their alliance with England and with the Holy Roman Empire, so Austria, for the Habsburg family. So a large war lasts about a decade. At towards the end of it, Barcelona is under siege for 14 months. And the leader of the city at the time, Rafael Casanovas, he refuses to give up until he is injured. And being taken out of action, the rest of the leaders kind of open the city and say, we can't last any longer. And so that opening happens on September 11th. The leaders are all arrested, they're imprisoned, and hence become martyrs. Right. But And 1714 does lead to major changes in Barcelona, from the architecture. There's entire parts of the city that are torn down to build up in different ways. So it does really change the city. But it's not really remembered, or even the National Day as we think of it today doesn't really come into effect until 1888. So it's about 150 years later. That by this point, Barcelona as the capital of Catalonia is it's doing very, very well economically. It has done quite well because of its proximity to Europe, particularly France, because of the ports. It's done a lot of trade, and it's built up quite a bourgeoisie, especially in textiles. So they're buying and selling textiles. And this is the part that's called the Catalan Renaissance. It's when Gaudí is building all of the buildings that we now associate so much with Catalonia. It's the time in which a Catalan dictionary is codified and published. It's a time of quite a lot of wealth and cultural endeavors and cultural investment happening within Catalonia. The rest of Spain is kind of lagging behind, so it creates a little bit of that division. And essentially in 1888, as the city is getting together to put up a big exhibition, it's when the Parc de la Ciutadella and these like parts of Barcelona that are quite touristic today are built. And they include a statue to Rafael Casanovas, that leader of the city. And so in 1888, on September 11th, all these Catalan bourgeois industrial manufacturers, these people who have quite a bit of money and are investing a lot in local cultural elements, have an homage to Casanovas and to all of these leaders during the siege, and march through the city, beginning at the statue. So they start repeating that year after year, Spain has a turbulent history with lots of dictatorships. So you have dictatorships that come in, like Primo de Rivera.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, bans it. And then the Second Spanish Republic, and it comes back, right? So you have this, like, back and forth as to what's happening. Needless to say, throughout the Franco regime, it was very not done. It was prohibited. And then Franco died in November of 75, so after the September 11th. So the first September 11th after Franco is 1976.
Right.
When they have to let it happen, but simultaneously the military is still in enough power. They don't want to do it in Barcelona. So they decide to go for this small town, well, especially at the time, a small town called Sant Boi de Llobregat. It's, especially at the time, hard to get there. You need cars, you need buses. So they're expecting that to really tone down the amount of people that go. And if it ends up being, like, poorly attended, they're hoping it won't continue. Instead, it is hugely attended, and it becomes this point of pride to go through all the difficulties of travel to get there. So, and you have this whole generation of college students from the 70s that all talk, having been there. And so that really builds a lot of impetus to get this event starting again in post-dictatorial Catalonia. And it becomes a really important element of local cultural, cultural events and nationalism.
And now, is it held all over Catalonia now?
Yeah. So originally, like I said, it's the September 11th celebrations are meant to replicate that march that happened in 1888, the parade through the city.
Yeah.
In practice, that has not always happened.
Okay.
So, I mean, when they had to do it in other towns, doesn't happen. And then there are quite a few events. I mean, this year, for example, especially because of COVID and the kind of like limitations that places on not only gatherings, but travel, the event is instead being held in local towns all over the region to try to keep all of that as small as possible.
Yeah.
So that's an example of it not happening directly in Barcelona. What's happened since about 2010 is that the flavor of the parade has changed. From 1976 to 2010, you definitely had people who believed and advocated for independence participating. But it was very much about identity. It was very much about reivindicating Catalan identity within a broader Spanish country. With 2010, a bunch of political events happen. The Spanish Constitutional Court strikes down major elements of the Catalan Autonomous Agreement signed after the transition.
So that was Zapatero was in government then, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. What happened in 2010?
Well, I preceded you slightly. but yeah, 2010 is kind of this, it changes everything, and it really breathes life into the independence movement in a way that didn't quite exist before.
Wow.
And that's not to say that there wasn't an element of wouldn't it be nice, and there wasn't an element of Catalan identity kind of thinking of itself as not Spanish. But this is the moment where it becomes untenable for many Catalans to continue as part of Spain, and you get into the now current kind of split, 50-50 split of should they stay or go. As I mentioned, the Spanish Constitutional Court comes out over the summer. And so 1979, right after the transition is ended, Spain and Catalonia sign an autonomous agreement that gives the region certain powers, economic and cultural. And this is meant to keep the country united post-dictatorship, but also kind of appease, especially left-wing groups throughout. Throughout the regions. So I'll mention that autonomous agreements were signed with Catalonia, but also the Basque Country and other regions of Spain. However, in 2010, the Catalan agreement was altered. essentially the Constitutional Court said that the autonomous agreement signed was not in keeping with the Spanish Constitution, and therefore cannot be upheld as written. And it mostly primarily impacts the economy and how Catalonia holds its money. But it also goes after some cultural elements. So the biggest one being that Catalonia no longer has a right to describe itself as a nation.
Right, yeah, I've heard this, and, yeah.
Yeah, and so this becomes kind of this like symbolic sticking point.
Right.
It's not just sticking a knife in the back, but it's like twisting it while you're doing
it.
And 2010, it's also 2 years into the global economic meltdown that has massive impacts in Spain, and makes the way that taxes and money is being distributed across Spain problematic, especially for Catalans whose economy is very strong, much stronger than other parts of Spain, with the exception of Madrid, and yet is not seeing as much return from its economic investment because of how the money is being split up. By 2010, you're also seeing, you're getting a lot of corruption scandals uncovered. And so
in Spain or Catalonia or both?
Oh, both.
Oh, okay.
All over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just people have reached a level of frustration with the entire system. That really begins this push for Catalan independence. And I mean, as I've mentioned before, that the independence movement combines all these parties that have very different aims. So there's not much of homogeneity within the Catalan independence movement other than independence. But I will say that there was almost like a sense of an awareness that all politicians are corrupt, but if they're going to be corrupt, at least for it to be the Catalan politicians instead of the Spanish ones.
Right.
Like a very But I mean, one of the biggest corruption scandals uncovered during this is that Jordi Pujol, the big heroic president of Catalonia, has been squirreling away money to Swiss bank accounts throughout his presidency. And so have his family, right? So like the same person who has fought for all these rights for Catalonia was the first guy who was also taking
money.
So the idea is not that Spain is so terrible that we must be independent, as much as in a region that is so overwhelmed of corruption, at least we're only dealing with one corruption instead of multiple levels of corruption. So 2010 becomes this moment, and there's massive protests after the Constitutional Court strikes down this agreement. And I mean, overwhelmingly massive protests. The photos out of Barcelona are absolutely insane. And there's this thought that maybe it can be replicated on September 11th, and it is. The numbers with Catalan protests are also always very different from what the police says versus what organizers say.
Right, yeah.
But they're consistent. They start saying it's 1.5 million people. 1.5 million people are showing up. And you start getting these photos that are now kind of really related to September 11th, where you see the avenues of Barcelona just full with people.
Wow.
The photos are taken from the rooftops, and now drones, but from the rooftops that show these kind of like endless seas of people. So in 2010, 2011, this group of politicians, it's a grassroots movement called the Assemblea Nacional de Catalunya, or the Catalan National Assembly, they get together and decide to try to make a grassroots movement for independence. And the more left-leaning of them are like a new democratic system that we can take into independence. But they start organizing and they take over the September 11th organizations. So if up until then it's been more about Catalan identity, it's now full on Catalan independence. And so they try to do a yearly event that is kind of designed to get as many eyeballs as possible. So these overwhelming seas of people in the streets. In 2013, they did a human chain from the northernmost point of Catalonia to the southernmost point. So it's over 400 kilometers of roadways with people holding hands from one end to the other. They've done events where everybody's gathered in Barcelona and they all change their shirts at the same time so that everybody the wave of all these multicolored shirts suddenly all becomes a solid block of yellow. They do all sorts of events like that to try to prove not just the massive support for independence, because a big thing that Spain consistently says is that this is a very vocal minority, but that there's a silent majority who is opposed to independence. So there's a big push to try to show as many people as possible to prove that it's not a minority. And simultaneously, because politically everything is so fractured within the movement, to try to show unification within the movement. And I think that performance is much more interesting for the protesters. To be like, hey, we're all in this together. But it's definitely something that, like I said, they is actively planned for large avenues with little tree cover to try to prove this mass of people and to try to get drone footage or anything that can then be sent out to international news audiences. Because within Spain and within Catalonia, this story, I mean, it's been a debate for decades and even centuries now. But where the Catalan independence movement is particularly hoping to get some pressure so that a referendum can legally be held is from international groups.
Like the EU and other countries, I suppose, And 2017 really did pick up things, didn't it? Have you seen a noticeable change since then?
Immediately after the referendum, with the call for independence, the Declaration of Independence that lasted 17 seconds, but especially with the arrest and exile of so many politicians, yes, things have definitely changed. While before the referendum, there were sometimes these elements of a historical reason, right? That independence was required because of Franco. That collapse has become much more present post referendum. Because who else sent people into exile? Well, that was the Franco regime. When else was police brutality as present on the streets of Catalonia as it had been during the referendum, during the Franco regime? So those kinds of that time of that historical time between the Spanish Civil War and the Franco regime, and now like since 2010, I have seen it really collapse. So while arguments that were being made in 2010, 2011, 2012, included cultural issues, but were more primarily focused on the economy, economic control. It's now become much more about righting past wrongs and those kinds of ideas. I will say, I think there's strong arguments in either direction. I will say that the Catalan government, in part because it is so fractured within itself, does bring out cultural events and historical events and historical memory in a way that is politically advantageous. So they, shortly before the referendum, put out a forgiveness so all the executions, the exiles, everything that Franco did, the Spanish constitution holds up as legal. What Catalonia did in 2017 was give a pardon to all the individuals within Catalonia who were exiled or executed or imprisoned by the Franco regime. And this was a great way to try to get support to say, like, see, you vote for us during the referendum and we will right the past wrongs of history. The thing is, from my perspective, the Catalan government it's the Franco government that did those things. So the Catalan local government that was illegal at the time of Franco giving this pardon makes no sense. It has no power to do so. But you'll see since then, like, moments in which when things in Catalonia politically are really fractured, they'll come out with some other kind of event or commemoration or edict to try to call upon this history and get support behind them as the people who are writing the past wrongs. And that's how Catalonia is manipulating that. It comes in both directions. There's certainly a far right push in the rest of Spain that has come out of, especially recently, and that very much apologizes for, not, and I don't mean apologizes and says that what Franco did was wrong, but has this, we were better off with Franco kind of element to it.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad sort of vibe, yeah.
Yeah, well, and the economy was okay, and the Catalans were unruly, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So there was recently a big memorial that was done in Madrid for all the individuals who were executed in one of the cemeteries that the new mayor, who is of the Conservative Party, ordered to be taken down. And photos then came out of the marble that had had all the names etched on it, thrown, broken on the floor. So it was on top of that, like I said, this very disrespectful way of taking it down, the twisting the knife element. Yeah. And I will say one of the arguments that I hear about Catalan independence lately and that I can't help but feel sympathetic towards is one that says, well, the reason that Catalonia can't have a referendum legally is that this constitution declares it illegal of them. But the Spanish constitution also upholds all of these horrific things that happened during the Franco regime. You have the stealing of children, mass executions, exile, taking of property, imprisonment, etc., all sanctioned kind of by the Spanish constitution, because that was the transitional agreement. So I hear this argument for Catalan independence that isn't so much about Catalan independence but about breaking the Spanish constitution to allow for those past wrongs to be made right.
I can completely see it, really, because like a lot of government after government of the left and right have refused to deal with the history, and it seems that Catalan independence is sort of a symptom. Like it's grown because of this inability to deal with history. And as for the constitution, I mean, you know, the PSOE and the PP were able to amend it because the EU wanted them to amend it for budgetary reasons, I think back in 2013 or something. And you're in America right now, and you know better than anyone that constitutions can be amended. So, and they always talk about, you know, Catalonia needs to get their constitution amended first, but it's been trying democratically for years, hasn't it? Thank you for the explainer on the National Day. That's incredibly interesting. And so just a one or two more questions for you. So you are Catalan, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am from Barcelona. I'm from the Gràcia neighborhood, which is right central Barcelona. And yeah, my parents, we left Europe actually back in the late 90s for my father's job. He worked in oil. And so I grew up very much bouncing around different places, depending on where oil was. So lots of different countries. But most of my formative education has been in the US, which means I have this great American accent. but it's also can be quite useful. I mean, there's, especially as I'm doing research that looks into the transition, looks into things related to the Franco regime, it's sometimes really difficult to get into archives. And it's particularly difficult, and there's always, and I've heard this from many other Catalan researchers, that there's this intimidation factor that comes in, especially when you're Catalan, and your Spanish has that accent, and your name might appear very Catalan. Enter military archives and to ask for these documentations and to sometimes get, have really poor experiences. I know quite a lot of Americans, because I'm working in America, that are collaborating with researchers in Spain and are always like, yeah, why do they always ask us to go talk to the archive? We have terrible accents in Spanish to hide that identity. Wow. So it's actually quite useful. I mean, my name works in both languages very well. So it's just a matter of accents to mark it, Adeline or not. And then when needed, I can just pull out what sounds like, I mean, I sound like a foreigner.
Yeah.
It's been a big aid in trying to get at more kind of divisive questions in Spain.
No, that's interesting. In your research, being in your position that you are in, you know, coming from Catalonia but moving around, I suppose you've got a bit more of an objective opinion about, you know, what constitutes Catalan identity. I mean, there's always this terrible stereotype of Catalonia versus Spain and how they're different, but no one really ever concentrates on just the one entity. So I just wondered if you would like share your thoughts on, you know, what do you think it means to be Catalan in this day and age, and maybe in the past, and how is the regional identity, mm-hmm. how is it like formed, and what does it consist of?
Right. Yeah, I think that the stereotypical answer to this question is always to reference back to Seni Rauxa, which the idea Sen is wisdom, Rauxa is kind of like passion. Uh-huh. So the idea that Catalans are, you know, like, well, Spain is the Furia Roja, right? That like the football red team of the bullfighting, all these things. Uh-huh. Catalonia is tempered by this wisdom, this thoughtfulness, but when needed, you know, we'll go out on the streets and protests.
Right.
And I do think that that is an important part of how Catalans understand themselves, and therefore mm-hmm. it's referenced often. It's a big part of how the region views itself as different and therefore as unique. Mm-hmm. But I think actually, if you track down back where that saying comes from, it becomes a little more clear where Catalonia comes from. Seni Rauxa and these concepts come out of this Catalan Renaissance in the 1800s, in the mid-1800s. So it comes out of the industrialization that happens very unevenly in Spain. Mm-hmm. Catalonia industrializes, the Basque country industrializes, but the rest of Spain very much sticks to a more agricultural system. And it's one of the big things that leads to the Spanish Civil War is this fight between a push for modernity, right? A push for all of these communist ideals and leftist ideals that are coming out of Europe versus the large agricultural kind of compounds that are happening all over the south and central of Spain.
Uh-huh.
So Catalan identity comes very much out of this split. Uh-huh. And it comes very much out of Catalonia and the Catalan economy in the mid-1800s. Being so, I don't want to use judgmental terms like advanced or anything like that. It's just very different.
Yeah, industrialized earlier, really.
Yeah. And so that leads to things like Gaudí. It uh-huh. leads to this big push for the Catalan language and the dictionary. It leads to a lot of kind of universities forming, a lot of connections mm. with other parts of Europe. And leads to the construction, and I mean every national identity is a construction for what it's uh-huh. worth, but it leads to the construction of Catalan identity in Catalonia. And so there's a forward-looking way to understand it, which is we are more connected to Europe. We have these rail lines, we have this commerce, we have these painters and these architects that are being recognized internationally. Uh-huh. But then there's also that element of kind of revisionist history in the past, uh-huh. where Catalonia, the Catalan countries, as they're called, were a medieval kind of trading empire block connection. Uh-huh. So that is the current Catalonia, Valencia, the Balearic uh-huh. Islands, slightly into southern France. Mm-hmm. So Perpignan and that kind of southern coast mm-hmm. And Sardinia. And this whole kind of, like I said, medieval trading empire crumbles in 1299, but it is still referenced as like the Catalan countries are these
regions. Right, okay. Yeah.
And Catalonia comes out of this history, and Spain comes out of a different history, and we have the Mediterranean instead of Northern Africa. And so you get this kind of, for me, it's really integral to how people think, how Catalans understand themselves today, and particularly this idea that we are more European than Spain. That very much comes out of this Renaissance in the 1800s, and how there's a lot of value put upon the language, upon local culture, upon architecture, that continues into contemporary Catalan identity, very much so. And sometimes leads to this kind of xenophobic, we are not from Spain, we are not from North America. Also leads to slightly, the word just escaped me. But yeah, the slightly kind of like snobby attitude of we are architecture or art or things like that. But I also think it leads to this understanding of Catalonia as very much a region that comes out of the industrial period and comes out of strong economic background, comes out of local investment into local groups. Which continues to this day.
Well, it's very interesting. No, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Yep, thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely.
And happy Catalan National Day, everybody.
Yes. Yeah, it's referenced to as La Diada, so it's Happy Diada.
La Diada. Happy Diada. Brilliant.
But yeah, absolutely. It's always wonderful to talk about this and this history. It's especially polarized in Spain, so it's really hard to have these conversations. So it's always nice to be able to have this discussion without it becoming this very personal, political kind of conversation.
Yeah, I've been to Barcelona like lots of times, and I've met the most, you know, people from all different intellectual backgrounds, different social backgrounds and things. And the minute you mention independence, whether they support it or are against it, they just turn into, you know, a completely sort of different person, really.
And it happens outside of Spain too. My husband is from the UK actually, and didn't quite ever believe me about all of this till we took a family trip to Madrid, and my mother was chatting in Catalan with her sister, and we were walking slightly behind, and an elderly woman, you know, the typical Spanish abuela, looked very, very nice, but she heard them and spit at them.
Jesus.
And my husband was like, how is this possible?
Wow.
It goes in every direction. People really become quite overwhelmed with this with this political argument.
And just for balance, I live in Madrid, and you know, I've heard Madrileños saying, yeah, I really wanted to go and watch, you know, Real Madrid at New Camp, but so we literally took the train that would get us there. We go straight to the stadium and we come straight back. You know, we don't want to spend any time there. And I think between Madrid and Barcelona, and that will probably be another episode to do. But there's definitely a huge rivalry, and it really isn't just football clubs. It's really quite deep, isn't it? Yeah, it's huge.
There's a really wonderful book about this actually called Fear and Loathing in La Liga by Sid Lowe. And it's all about the rivalry in sports and how history gets collapsed and also revised. Because it's, you know, revised so that Madrid can be the team of Franco and Barcelona can be the team of the resistance, which is not historically accurate, but allows that division. And he tells this really interesting story from David Beckham's first trip to Nou Camp, and kind of being warned that he has to get aisle and he has to bend down because of all the bottles that are going to start hitting the bus, and he doesn't quite believe it until it starts. It definitely goes in both directions. I've rented a car in Spain with Madrid plates around Catalonia, and the windshield kept getting burst from fireworks when we parked overnight. I've been in a lot of other parts of Spain and talked about my research or talked about this and gotten a lot of anger thrown back at me. the whole country. Like, no one can have a rational conversation about this topic, unfortunately.
No, well, I'll finish on a positive note. I do think, you know, I'm not the biggest fan in the world of the Pessoa or Pedro Sanchez, but I do think it seems to be a bit more human its moment yes. than it has ever been.
Yeah, there are a lot of frustrations that I hear within the country, but I have to say I have a side interest in, within my research, a side interest in how there were 15,000 Spanish Republicans who ended up in death camps during World War II. Their history has been entirely ignored by Spanish governments for years and years and years. Pedro Sanchez is the first government I've seen do official homages within Spain. They recently had an event. It was the first, the last survivor of Mauthausen, the last Spanish survivor of Mauthausen, got to attend and was honored in person. I mean, a lot of this has been really disrupted with COVID, but it's the first government that I see taking historical memory just a bit more seriously and making it a big part of their political platform. There are cynical views on why this is, on keeping the left appeased or things like that. But slightly, I'm of the opinion of like, okay, but at least we're getting this history out in the open. And especially because people are unable to have this conversation rationally, I think that this, it's important to kind of bring up these histories again and get them remembered, have people know their own history. It's really important.
100%, definitely. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you for having me.